Tel Aviv, Israel. Jürgen Vormbrunn has a passion for Ethiopian food, which is our reason for meeting at a falafel restaurant. With his bright pink skin and white, unruly eyebrows that match his Einstein hair, he might be mistaken for a crazed scientist or college professor. He is neither. Although never acknowledging which Israeli intelligence service he was and possibly still is employed by, he openly admits that at one point he could be called a spy.
Most people don't believe something can happen until it already has. That's not stupidity or weakness. That's just human nature. I don't blame anyone for not believing. I don't claim to be any smarter or better than them. I guess what it really comes down to is the randomness of birth. I happen to be born into a group of people who live in constant fear of extinction. It's part of our identity, part of our mindset. And it has taught us through horrific trial and error to always be on our guard. The first warning I had of the plague was from our friends and customers over in Taiwan. They were complaining about our new software decryption program. Apparently it was failing to decode some emails from PRC sources, or at least decoding them so poorly that the text was unintelligible. I suspected the problem might not be in the software, but in the translated messages themselves. The mainland Reds, I guess they weren't really Reds anymore, but what do you want from an old man? The Reds had a nasty habit of using too many different computers from too many different generations and countries. Before I suggested this theory to Taipei, I thought it might be a good idea to review the scrambled messages myself. I was surprised to find the characters themselves were perfectly decoded, but the text itself, it all had to do with a new viral outbreak that first eliminated its victim, then reanimated his corpse into some kind of homicidal berserker. Of course, I didn't believe this was true, especially because only a few weeks later the crisis in the Taiwan Strait began, and any messages dealing with rampaging corpses abruptly ended. I suspected a second layer of encryption, a code within a code. That was pretty standard procedure, going back to the first days of human communication. Of course, the Reds didn't mean actual dead bodies. It had to be a new weapon system or ultra-secret war plan. I let the matter drop. Try to forget about it. Still, as one of your great national heroes used to say, my spider sense was tingling. Not long afterward, at the reception for my daughter's wedding, I found myself speaking to one of my son-in-law's professors from Hebrew University. The man was a talker, and he had a little too much to drink. He was rambling about how his cousin was doing some kind of work in South Africa and had told him some stories about golems. You know about the golem, the old legend about a rabbi who breathes life into an inanimate statue. Mary Shelley stole the idea for her book Frankenstein. I didn't say anything at first, just listened. The man went on blathering about how these golems weren't made from clay, nor were they docile and obedient. As soon as he mentioned reanimating human bodies, I asked for the man's number. It turns out he had been in Cape Town on one of those adrenaline tours. Shark feeding, I think it was.
He rolls his eyes.
Apparently the shark had obliged him, right in the tochas, which is why he had been recovering at Route Shur when the first victims of Khayelitsha Township were brought in. He hadn't seen any of these cases firsthand, but the staff had told him enough stories to fill my old dictaphone. I then presented his stories along with those decrypted Chinese emails to my superiors. And this is where I directly benefited from the unique circumstances of our precarious security. In October of 1973, when the Arab sneak attack almost drove us into the Mediterranean, we had all the intelligence in front of us, all the warning signs, and we had simply dropped the ball. We had never considered the possibility of an all-out, coordinated, conventional assault from several nations, certainly not on our holiest of holidays. From 1973 onward, if 9 intelligence analysts came to the same conclusion, it was the duty of the 10th to disagree. No matter how unlikely or far-fetched a possibility might be, one must always dig deeper. If a neighbor's nuclear power plant might be used to make weapons-grade plutonium, you dig. If a dictator was rumored to be building a cannon so big it could fire anthrax shells across whole countries, you dig. And if there was even the slightest chance that dead bodies were being reanimated as ravenous killing machines, you dig and dig until you struck the absolute truth. And that is what I did. I dug. At first, it wasn't easy. With China out of the picture, the Taiwan crisis put an end to any intelligence gathering, I was left with very few sources of information. A lot of it was chaff, especially on the Internet. Zombies from space and Area 51. What is your country's fetish for Area 51 anyway? After a while, I started to uncover more useful data. Cases of rabies similar to Cape Town. It wasn't called African rabies until later. I uncovered the psychological evaluations of some Canadian mountain troops recently returned from Kyrgyzstan. I found the blog records of a Brazilian nurse who told her friends all about the murder of a heart surgeon. The majority of my information came from the World Health Organization. The UN is a bureaucratic masterpiece, so many nuggets of valuable data buried in mountains of unread reports. I found incidents all over the world, all of them dismissed with plausible explanations. These cases allowed me to piece together a cohesive mosaic of this new threat. The subjects in question were indeed dead. They were hostile, and they were undeniably spreading. Given their global nature, I thought it might be prudent to seek confirmation from foreign intelligence circles. Paul Knight had been a friend of mine for a long time, going all the way back to Entebbe. The idea to use a double of Amin's black Mercedes, that was him. Paul had retired from government service right before his agency's reforms and gone to work for a private consulting firm in Bethesda, Maryland. When I visited him at his home, I was shocked to find that not only had he been working on the very same project on his own time, of course, but that his file was almost as thick and heavy as mine. We sat up the whole night reading each other's findings. Neither of us spoke. I don't think we were even conscious of each other, the world around us, anything except the words before our eyes. We finished almost at the same time, just as the sky began to lighten in the east. Paul turned the last page, then looked to me and said very matter-of-factly, "This is pretty bad, huh?" I nodded, so did he, and then followed up with, "So, what are we going to do about it?"
And that is how the Warmbrunn Knight Report was written.
I wish people would stop calling it that. There were 15 other names on that report. Virologists, intelligence operatives, military analysts, journalists, even one UN observer who had been monitoring the elections in Jakarta when the first outbreak hit Indonesia. Everyone was an expert in his or her field. Everyone had come to their own similar conclusions before ever being contacted by us. Our report was just under 100 pages long, It was concise. It was fully comprehensive. It was everything we thought we needed to make sure this outbreak never reached epidemic proportions. I know a lot of credit has been heaped upon the South African war plan, and deservedly so. But if more people had read our report and worked to make its recommendations a reality, then that plan would have never needed to exist.
But some people did read and follow your report. Your own government.
Barely. And just look at the cost.